tonight's mystery sound. Tonight's $50,000 mystery sound.
Ah! Oh, God, now I knew it. Oh, sorry.
We'll have to start that all over again. Bring it up, Big Jay, please. I'll give you a cue, at least a small clue on this thing. That mystery sound has to be identified in less than 3.5 seconds. Bring it up there, Big. Oh, you've already lost. Too bad. What a silly world. I've just lit one of those exploding cigars. I love them that way. You gotta see this little bibby when it goes off. Close the top of your head right off. The cigar with a snap. Hey, can you imagine what Winston Churchill would say if he were alive today to see this current rash of blueberry-flavored cigars? Have you seen those little cigars? Blueberry-flavored, burgundy wine-flavored, applejack-flavored cigars. Oh, yes, attar of roses-flavored. I can just see poor old Winnie saying, "Never in man's long and checkered past and history has he so succumbed to the basest and the most primitive of evil." I agree with him. Oh, man, I saw a guy the other day over in Charlie Brown smoking a blueberry-flavored cigar. I almost flew up, if I may use Dorothy Parker's great line. Of course, that's basically American. That is. I mean, we have an insensate desire to turn whatever we've got around us into something that looks like something else. Now, this explains why somebody thought in terms of building the flagship out on Route 22. That beautiful monument of insanity. You know the flagship, huh? Isn't that a beautiful thing? Now, whatever made a guy decide to build a building in the shape of a flagship, a ship, is basically American. There's something about us that makes us do this. You won't see this any other part of the world. You will not see a hot dog stand in the shape of a derby hat in, let's say, Denmark. You won't. You will not. And we constantly do this. I mean, it's an American thing. And so the idea to take a cigar and make it taste like a pile of blueberry leaves burning is a basic American concept. And, that's only part of the whole, it's part of our culture. Let's admit it, a part of our culture. And the other day, I'm reading in the New York Times, and I came across, of course, you probably saw this piece. If you didn't, you better listen, man, because it's one of the most American pieces I've read in a long time. Would you please give me a little Salute America music? Bring it up big there. Thank you, Jane. Oh, hooray for the U.S. of A. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, marching ever onward, bigger and greater as we go home, ho-ho. Triple strength and total giant size packages. That's very good, Jay. Thank you. Reset that. We'll need that. I'd like to salute a basic American person. And, I would like to read part of this piece for you. Because what this guy is doing, when you really think about it, it has overtones of Samuel Beckett. I mean, Waiting for Godot. Has overtones of Herman Melville, Captain Ahab, The Pursuit of the Unbelievable. And, the more I think about us, the more I think that we're probably the first people on the face of the globe that are almost psychopathic romantics. I mean, we've carried romanticism beyond the boundaries of human realization to the point today where the average American, he can get into paroxysms of excitement, contemplating utopia. And of course, it's a very private utopia. So this problem is going to eventually do what it did to Quixote. And you go galloping into those windmills, you ought to get clopped in the back of the head by a big fan blade. Decapitate you just like that. I mean, if you persist in believing it's something else. But that's the, you know, that's beside the point. Only in America could they have written a song about the impossible dream. That's such a pure American thing. And the fact that it is an impossible dream, you know, the key word is impossible. Not dream, but impossible. And the fact that it is an impossible dream makes it so basically nonsensical as to be, well, it's the kind of thing that, that Lewis Carroll would have enjoyed, really. And certainly the kind of thing that old man Pickwick, do you ever read the Pickwick Papers? Boy, that's pure Pickwickian logic. Oh, the impossible dream. Yeah, that's it's just the way it is. But I would like to salute a pure American phenomena. And it occurs in Crazy Horse, South Dakota. Isn't that an exciting name, Crazy Horse, South Dakota? Everything is big. And I'm going to quote this article from the New York Times by B. Drummond Ayers, Jr., special to the New York Times. Crazy Horse, South Dakota. Everything is big in the world of Korchak Chulkovsky. He stands more than 6 feet. He tops 230 pounds. His shaggy salt-and-pepper beard tumbles down a full 8 inches onto his barrel chest, which periodically sends forth foghorn hoots and laughs. He has 10 children, 5 boys and 5 girls, for whom he has single-handedly fashioned a home of 57 rooms and 161 doors that zigzag like a broken field runner through 100 shady yards of ponderosa pine. And then there is the mountain. The mountain. It thrusts up 600 feet through the grove of trees, a jagged hulk of rusty granite that dominates the lesser peaks in this central part of the Black Hills, the way Mr. Zolkovsky dominates the kinfolks, guests, and hangers-on who gather nightly around his banquet-sized communal table to sip his good whiskey, savor his wife's country cooking, and reel under his arm-waving commentary on homesteaders, placer mines, Paul Harvey, Paderewski, and the American Indian. How did Paul Harvey get in on that? Through the Zolkovskys of the world, men and women whose minds and hands are always in gear, a mountain is inevitably a challenge. But for Korchak Zolkovsky, a self-taught sculptor born 61 years ago in Boston, the challenge is not the usual climb. Did you read about what he's doing? You agree that it's worth putting on tape and recording for posterity. Did you hear about this guy? He is whittling 18 million tons of stone into modern man's largest sculpture, a $10 million, 560 feet by 640 foot statue of the great Sioux chief, Crazy Horse, astride a galloping pony and pointing toward the dark hills, the grassy valleys, and the rushing white waters that he loves so much. As Mr. Zolkovsky envisions the monument, it will be so big that all four of the 60-foot heads on Mount Rushmore, on which he learned mountain carving under the guidance of Gutzon Borglum, all four of these heads could be hidden behind the chief's head. Well, have you ever seen that thing out there? Well, it's incredible. This, you know, these fantastic heads. Well, he could put all four of them behind the chief's head. The recently unveiled bas-relief of Confederate leaders on Stone Mountain near Atlanta, a work that's as big as a football field, would be lost behind the pony alone. Listen to this figure. 4,000 men could stand on Crazy Horse's outstretched left arm, and a 10-story building could fit beneath it. Mr. Zolkovsky has no doubt that he can successfully complete his task. It is simple, he says. I am a sculptor. I tell stories in stone. This is a story. I want very much to tell it. All right, there it is. For a chisel, Mr. Zolkovsky has a $145,000 rock drill that roars like a prehistoric monster that once roamed the hills around where he's doing his work. His mallet is a well-isolated storehouse packed full of dynamite. And to finance the project, which carries a non-profit label, he lets the Walter Mitties of the world peek at his progress for $2 a shot. He also receives some gifts, such as a tractor and so forth. And he's going to build this fantastic thing. Well, there it is. Now, that is pure American. That is absolutely, that's something that this country does to people. And I think you could travel all over the world and never find anybody who would even think in terms of this, of constructing a monster sculptor like that. And by the way, here's a picture of a sculptor, and it looks like a pretty bad piece of sculpture, actually. I hate to tell you. I mean, did you see it? He's got a piece, he's got a little model of it, see? And it looks like the kind of sculptor that you see on the bottom of lamps. You know, the kind that shows a leopard made out of this black ceramic with the little green glass eyes and that kind of stuff. He's that kind of sculptor, you know. But nevertheless, the idea that he's going to build this fantastic thing is part of that thing that's American. Now, you know, living in the city, I'm sure a lot of you have never really run into this kind of nuttiness. Because the very fact of city life limits you for that kind of thing. Oh, no, I've run into guys. I'm going to tell you some story tonight about great, sad, unbelievable human, creations. That's all the only thing you can call them, because they never really come out. Did I ever tell you about the time the two guys built the airplane when I was a kid? Well, now, you know, building an airplane is not an easy thing to do. And, you know, this is a specific American idea, that building aircraft, and, you know, it's a tremendously new hobby, you know, this whole idea of building an airplane. And it's taking off. Building anything, building something big, building a boat. This is almost exclusively American. The people have lived for years in France and never thought in terms of building their own airplane. The concept maybe it's something in our atmosphere. Maybe it's something in the air. Now, I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. It's there. You know, it's very definitely there. In fact, right now, the idea of self-created aircraft is almost exclusively an American phenomenon. And you know, there's a whole underbelly of people that do this. You know, they have a yearly convention, for example, of home-built aircraft, and it occurs every year in Rockford, Illinois, which is the home base of that. You notice it's a non-city situation? And thousands of these aircraft, they have to fly to get there. In other words, the point being, it's a fly-in. So you don't just carry it on a truck and show it to it. And something like 50,000 of them arrive. And some of them are powered, you know, one of the most popular home-built aircraft today is powered with a Volkswagen engine. This is WOR New York. Another engine they use is the Chevy Corvair. You know, the air-cooled engine? And so building an aircraft is an American thing. And I remember as a kid, one time, these two guys, whom I barely knew. I mean, they just lived in the neighborhood, that's all. They were just older men type, and they lived in the neighborhood. And they started to build an airplane. Now, they had no knowledge of aircraft. They sent away for the plans. Now, Popular Mechanics is as pure an American magazine, believe me, it's far purer than the celebrated remark of, who was it, H. Rapp Brown, who said violence is as, you know, American as apple pie. That's ridiculous. Violence has been a world phenomenon forever. Or doesn't he know about Attila the Hun, who was definitely not from Ohio? Nevertheless, an apple pie is certainly not American either, particularly, because you can get apple pie a lot of places in the world. But Popular Mechanics is an American thing. The basement fooler arounder. The guy who is driven to send away for the plans to build the dirigible. And you can get the plans for 25 cents. and he starts to work on it. We had a guy, I remember Mr. Selke in our neighborhood. Ever tell you about Mr. Selke? And, you know, nobody in the neighborhood had more than two nickels to rub together, you know? But Mr. Selke, for some reason or other, he was out of work all the time, so he worked at the railroad. He was out of work. So Mr. Selke sent away for plans to build a pipe organ. Now, he couldn't play anything. I mean, that isn't a question. And not only that, it was a pipe organ with a color, well, like you know, there's this color screen thing that every time you play a note, on comes blue, you play another note in yellow and green, and it makes a vast, fantastic, psychedelic experience of wild colors and music. Well, he worked on this thing for 3 years. Until one day he had this pipe organ, it was made. He welded pieces of brass together that he got at the junkyard, and it was a pipe organ. And it had motors down in the basement that filled, you know, it would go. And about every two or three days, you'd hear him working on this thing, and you'd hear, giant note would go out all over the neighborhood, you know, and you'd see windows fluttering. Now, why in the hell he was building? Who knows why he was building? He was driven by forces that he had no control of. If you ever stopped Ahab on the poop deck of the Pequod, he said, "Now come on, it's only a fish. What's the matter? Leave him, you know, leave him be forgiven. You know, leave, live and let live." He would have thrown you overboard, but he couldn't have given you any reason why he had to get it either. Driven by forces that drive you deep into the night. And old man Selke built this enormous, fantastic pipe organ out of plans that he got from Popular Mechanics. And he actually finished it. And on the day that he finished it, or at least he thought, you know, it was ready to go. I mean, you know, what day do you finish an organ? I mean, there isn't one day when you put the last Vox Humana in place and you say, "Here it is. Well, now, let's see. Where's E. Power Biggs? Call him over. We'll go to work here." So what he did, he had a party. He invited everybody over. They had root beer, which they made in the basement. And everybody went up and looked at the organ. And he lit this big screen. It was a tremendous screen over the mantelpiece he had in his house. Great big white piece of glass, sort of glazed glass. And old man Selke stands up and he says, "Now watch this." The fantastic note, and you see this big blue thing come up on the screen. Beep, and up comes a yellow one. Boop, bah, boop. Well, everybody says, "Well, gee, that's fantastic." And nobody could play the organ in the neighborhood. Except one lady could play the piano, self-taught, you know, the kind that didn't read music. They always used to say, "Play by ear." So she sits down and goes, bum, 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 on this fantastic Wurlitzer organ, which he made. And you could see green and yellow and blue lights go off and on. That's the last we ever heard of it. I mean, you know, the saddest thing that could have happened to Ahab is if he caught that damn whale. Drag it back to New Bedford and so what? Anyone says, "Well, he caught him. Now what? How are you going to top that, Ahab?" "Well, you know, I'm going to charge admission. I'm coming to look at it." Or something. No, no. The greatest success of all is failure. Ultimately. That's why almost all great novels have been written about failure. Not success. Failure. Now, had Quixote galloped off and knocked over those windmills, who would have cared? I mean, had Hamlet been elected alderman in the last act, I mean, who cares? Had Orestes, you know, coming up there on those palace steps and torn down the whole palace, see? And the Electra says, "Well, we did it, didn't we? Well, what do you say now? So now we own the kingdom. What do you say we build a summer place down near the Thebes?" You know, I mean, that would have been, you know, who needs that, see? So failure is the ultimate success. Now, if this guy that we're reading about here finishes this miserable piece of sculpture, stands back, wipes his hands, and says, "There it is, look at that. 16 million feet high, 4,000 guys could stand on crazy horses single hand, outstretched, pointing to the purple hills of North Dakota? There it is. Somebody says, well, I don't know, the nose is kind of crooked. Ah, come on, what kind of horse is that? That's no quarter horse. Are you kidding me? Look at that horse. What kind of hocks do you call him? The next thing you know, he's arguing about whether or not it was a, you know, good piece of sculpture. And then the environmental protectionists are going to show up and say, well, look what you did in the mountain. You carved it all up and you made it into a bridge lamp. You know? So ultimately, I can only say that failure is a very, very good thing to aim for. It's the only way you're eventually going to be remembered. The great failures of the world. And then these two guys in our neighborhood, oh, I'll never forget this failure as long as I live. I learned a lesson, oh, fantastic lesson. These two guys lived two blocks down. And they were building an airplane in the backyard. Now, there's nobody alive, especially if he's a male, that isn't attracted by a flying machine. It is a basic primal attraction. Now, you also can be repelled. You can be afraid of it. But you are fascinated. That's a better word, fascinated. Because flying is a primary function. It's a primary animal function. Flying, walking, eating, procreation, battle. These are all primary functions, and so hence we are continually lured by these primary functions. Can you imagine a novel today without sex? Yeah. Well, primary function. Practically every novel is about war of one kind or another, too. It may be a battle between man and his environment. It may be a battle between men and men. It may be a battle for a man over a chick. But it's a battle. Almost all, have you noticed how many anti-war movies that are popping up, but they all have very gory war scenes in them? Everybody pretending he doesn't like it? What a joke. Listen, the guys that make war movies love war more than the guys that are in war. How do you like that for a bad statement? It's the truth. It never would have occurred, believe me, it never would have occurred to the average guy in a rifle platoon, the BAR man, we'll say, to make Catch 22. The minute he got out, he didn't want to hear any more about it. Forget it, man. And not only forget it, the best way to forget it is to bury it like it never happened. But when you keep picking at it, there's something that attracts you about it. Something that constantly lures you on. And these two guys built this airplane in the backyard, and we couldn't stay away from it. We'd all stand by the fence and watch that airplane. I mean, you know, it isn't everybody that's got an airplane in the backyard that's taking shape. I mean, you could see it. These guys had welding things out there, and they're building. I remember it had a tubular frame construction on the fuselage, and they had big drawings tacked up on the back of the garage next to where they were working, big drawings like blueprints they had. And every couple of days, these two guys who worked in the mill would be out there with welding tools, wearing these blue goggles, working away. And all of us would be standing there watching, me and Schwartz and Flick. It was an airplane. And at first, it just looked like a big bird cage. Then one day, it had two wheels on the bottom of the bird cage. Big, fat, black tires. Began to look like an airplane, or at least something like something that was moving. And they bought from someplace, which I to this day don't know where they got them, two wings came, arrived. Now, these wings had probably been on some absolutely possibly wrecked plane, who knows. But they got two big blue wings, which were propped up next to the garage. And they were in a kind of basic disarray, these two wings. Big numbers on them. I remember everybody standing around looking at these. Have you ever seen two big airplane wings? You know, an airplane wing of this type can be 30, 40 feet. The wingspan of an airplane, I think that particular plane was like about 35 feet. Standing up on end, that wing is 3 feet, 3 stories high. Everybody's staring, wow, you know, fantastic. And they're working on this airplane. And one day, the airplane disappeared completely. And the rumor got out that it was now down at the airport. They had taken it out in the night and towed it away. The airplane was just about ready to go. I remember my old man talking to Mr. Bruner next door one time about the motor these guys had in it. You know what they used for an engine in this thing? They actually used a Model A engine that was modified, had special modifications or something, and they'd reworked it, and there it was. That great airplane that had been built by these two guys. And they achieved a kind of heroic status because, you know, building something like that is not only is it a quixotic thing, but it also is a highly romantic thing. They could have built, say, a garage, or they could have built a sink. But to build an airplane says a lot about something. And then one day, I am walking out. This was kind of the denouement. A terrible scene. Before I tell you this, you got any whoopies in there for me? Hit the whoopee button, please. Anyone.
We took a big, quiet Ford Galaxy 500, and we added a vinyl roof. We added all vinyl interior trim and special metallic paint. We added chrome rocker panel moldings and chrome door edge guards for better-looking, longer-lasting value. And we added beautiful deluxe wheel covers. Yep, we added all those extras to a Ford Galaxy 500. And then cut the total price by $110. See for yourself, it's right there on the price sticker. Now stop and ask yourself a question. In these days of high costs, doesn't it make good sense to buy from the guy who gives you more? Galaxy 500 is the same luxury-equipped car it's always been. Still has that famous quiet ride. And right now, Ford Galaxy 500's got all those extras, and we actually cut the total price $110. Come on, see your Ford dealer during his economy drive.
Dubonnet, the drink that's like a woman. Soft, beautiful, with a little bite that makes it interesting. Dubonnet.
Like a woman when she's gone, the memory still lingers on. Ooh, like a woman.
Dubonnet. Some people like it straight and uncomplicated. Others like it mixed with a spritz of soda or on the rocks. That's all right, too. Any time of day. Because Dubonnet is gentle.
Ooh, like a woman.
Dubonnet. It all started in France. The drink that's like a woman.
Ooh, like a woman.
Maybe that's why men like it, too. Dubonnet Company, product of USA, New York. Available at fine restaurants and package stores.
Wait till women's lib hears of that. Dubonnet, like a woman. Hey, listen, speaking of great moments in life, I would like to suggest that if you're walking around this weekend and looking for some place to scoff, the great Shanghai is still persisting in that madness. They have their big Chinese brunch, and it goes from 11 o'clock until 3, and it's 103rd and Broadway uptown. And by the way, the ground rules are this. That for $2 and a half, you come in and you can eat anything you want. I mean, they have this big buffet type thing. And if you want to come in at 11 and stay till 3 and just shovel it in steadily, I mean, they won't say anything, but they're going to look awful bad at you. That's all. I mean, you know, the Chinese can look inscrutable. On the other hand, if you're a kid and you're under 4 feet tall, you get in for half price and you can also eat as much as you want. Now, they don't say how wide you can't be. So I've known some kids under 4 feet tall or 7 feet wide who, you know, they were total pigs. However, this is great Shanghai. Their food is great, and it's kind of a legendary place. Generations of Columbia students have fist-fought their way through school up there. This is the great Shanghai, 103rd and Broadway. The IRT comes right up there. Now, let's see. What do we have? We have another little dinghy? All right, hit the bell.
There exists on this continent a soft drink named Dr. Pepper. And the enlightened know the drink may challenge the glory of its flavor. But Dr. Pepper is different from other soft drinks, and there are those who choose to remain outside the boundaries of its joy. Lost people filled with superstition who misunderstand it. And so, we raise our voices unto you, Dr. Pepper, misunderstood for now, but gallantly awaiting the coming dawn of love and acceptance.
Hey, you know, while Dr. Pepper was dinging away there, I'm thinking that this is primarily a male thing. I don't want to infuriate the woman's lib, but this kind of madness where a man wants to make a fantastic statue out of an entire mountain is male. You can't conceive of Ahab being feminine. I mean, you know, writing the Ninth Symphony is Beethoven, you know, there it is. You know, what is it that makes him do this? And it's hard. A man can understand it. You know, any male listening to me now, he can vaguely appreciate the idea of a guy wanting to build this fantastic statue. But I'm sure, you notice they never mention his wife? And I could just see, I don't know what's the matter with him. Don't I make you happy enough, Slutkowski? What is it? And every morning at 4, he goes trotting off into the mountains carrying his dynamite. And by the way, he's got one great idea out there. In case you're curious, he's got a lot of things. Says, during the summer months when the work is going best, tremendous dynamite blasts shake the surrounding hills daily at noon and 5 p.m. See, he's carving this thing with dynamite. And every day, a drawing is held to determine which lucky visitor gets the honor of pushing the remote control plunger that sends 200 to 300 tons of rock crashing down. Now, there's another basic thing. Who hasn't felt the desire? Again, it must be male. I don't know. Who hasn't felt the desire to blow something up, you know, push the thing up, boom, bam. But I there's no way to explain it. I'm not trying to explain any of this stuff tonight. I'm just trying to say that this is the way it is. I mean, the idea that Columbus sailed across the ocean, I mean, he sailed. He had to do it. He just, no question about it, he had to do it. And so these two guys that built this airplane, they really taught me. I don't know whether they taught me a lesson or not, but I've never forgotten it. Because I was a witness to a peculiar sequel to the thing. It really wasn't a sequel. It was the final statement of that aircraft building. And like every kid, I suppose, that certainly lived in the 20th century, certainly every male kid, I was fascinated by and totally wound up with the idea of airplanes. I think one of the first things that the average boy draws is an airplane, either that or a racer. Do you agree with that? So, you know, you draw these things, and I was a real nut on airplanes. I'd never been close to one. That airplanes are always something that you see at like 5,000 feet above you. And the fact that these two guys were building an airplane right in the backyard was always exciting. And they had a big high fence to keep people out. You know, it was made out of chicken wire, but there it was. You could see through it, but you couldn't get over it. It was the kind of wire they have around tennis courts. And every couple of days, we'd go through the alley, and you'd see that airplane. And the day that they covered it with fabric. And it was beautiful. It was a dark royal blue, beautiful airplane. Sitting there on those two wheels. They didn't put the wings on. Apparently, they put the wings on it when they took it out to the airfield. And they towed it out there. Had a big yellow tail. There it was. It had two cockpits. And one day, it was gone. And it kind of disappeared from life. You know, just something, it just was gone, that was it. Life went on, it was hot summer. One winter went by. And one day, It was late in June or early in July. It was very close to the 4th of July. I remember that specifically because my old man had his fireworks stand already in action. So he usually started his fireworks stand about a month before the 4th of July. And I remember he was running that stand at that time. And it was on a Sunday afternoon. Now, why I remember those specifics, I do not know. But it was Sunday afternoon. And I was in the living room of the house. And it was hot. And it was about 2 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I walked out on the front porch. I was going down the street to see Flick. I walked out on the front porch, and I noticed over on the next house, Bruner's house, Mrs. Bruner was sitting on the porch swing, swinging back and forth. She always used to do that when old man Bruner didn't come home for 3 days. He wanted to keep an eye on the road. And she would swing back and forth. She was swinging back and forth. And all of a sudden, I hear this sound coming from a distance. Just like it filled the air. Just a strange... It was a hum. But it sort of filled the entire atmosphere. Just, there was no direction. You couldn't say, it's come from there, it's come from there. It was just a hum all over. And suddenly, without any warning, the Stryker house, Mrs. Stryker, who lived right across the street from us, I saw this thing come right over the house. It was fantastic. Right over the top of the house. It was about 75 feet right off the roof and went right over the street, right over my head. This twin wing that was a biplane with big yellow and green and blue wings just went right over the house. He must have cleared the roof of our house by no more than maybe 8 or 9 feet. It's fantastic. You could hear the entire neighborhood shake. Just everything shook, just roared over the neighborhood. And it sort of drilled off into the distance. Whoa. Have you ever seen an airplane crash? I have. I want to tell you, I ran down the steps. This thing had gone directly over my head, had disappeared over the back of the house and over the garage, over the alley. I ran up the driveway, and by that time, 5,000 people were coming out of houses. Screen doors were slamming. People were yelling. You could hear cars slamming on the brakes and guys running from all different directions. And it seemed like almost instantly you could hear sirens in the distance. I ran over the alley, and sure enough, there was a big vacant lot about 2 or 3 blocks away. Big vacant lot that had a little hill in it. And it was a sign, a big Mercury Motors sign. Remember, it had a big picture of a Mercury car on it. This thing went right past that sign and hit that hill right on the side going up. And that airplane was spread out over about 200 or 300 feet. Just spread out. Just tremendous pile of rubble. And that was the end of the two brothers who built the airplane. And the rumor got out around town that what they did that day, apparently had never taken any flying lessons. They decided to fly their airplane. It was done. And they did. That was the end of the saga. It's a fantastic moment. So where do you know? What about Ahab hanging on the side of the whale? One day this old geezer's out there going to be working away with his dynamite, blow himself right off the nose of Crazy Horse. And that's why guys paint posters like the Year One poster. Enigmatic, sinister, sneaky, full of deep and peculiar, convoluted meaning. And I would like to suggest that if you're part of the world of Ahab, the terrible drive and the urge to build something beyond your own scope, put $2 in the mail and get your first start towards that madness. Year One is the name of the poster. Send $2 in check or money order. Do not send cash. to Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York, and do it now. You are keeping yourself away from the mother load. The mother load of what? Who knows? That's part of the great mystery. And by the way, they'll send your dough back if you're not sculled out by this thing. It's a magnificent poster in about 6 million colors that quite possibly pays homage to the brothers who built the airplane. You never know why it is. What we are, we will never understand. There is no way for man to understand what man is. Why he writes novels, why he composes symphonies, why he chops big chunks of stone out to look like horses. You can't conceive of, say, a grizzly bear buying himself a chisel and deciding he's going to make himself a symbolic sculptor of a man standing athwart the eternal vast wasteness. You can't imagine a giraffe searching for his identity on the pages of a novel. It's only us. Poor, sad, fighting, struggling, unhappy, blissful, ecstatic us.